This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
A middle-aged couple befriends a pair of younger, hipper Brooklynites in Noah Baumbach's While We're Young. Starring Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts, it's now playing on demand. Nicole Kidman and Joseph Fiennes star as an Australian couple whose teenage children get lost in the desert in Strangerland. Premiering on demand on July 10th, the same day it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This episode of Film Spotting SVU is also supported by SundanceNow.club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. Discover unforgettable films you can't find anywhere else.
To get a free 30-day trial, go to docclub.com/SVU. That's docclub.com/SVU.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And this week on SVU, Matt's in Iceland, and I'm hanging out in Mumbai. But through the magic of a mysterious psychic bond, we're getting together to review the new Netflix series, Sense8. How's the weather over there in Iceland, Matt?
It's surprisingly warm, actually. It kind of feels, frankly, it feels a lot like Brooklyn. Yeah,
Mumbai as well. I hadn't expected.
Weird. I guess everywhere you go, there you are. Later in the show, we'll bring you Q Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now. And those are all centered on a common theme. Inspired by Sense8, we were going to go with movies set all over the globe in which characters of diverse backgrounds have psychic orgies. But we couldn't find enough movies to fill the segment. We had three. The classic three everyone always thinks of when they think of movies about people from all over the globe of diverse backgrounds with psychic orgies. There's Last Year at Marion Bad. There's Roger and Me, and there's Weekend at Bernie's. But those are the only three. There's no fourth
one. We needed four.
So instead, we're going to talk more about the creators of Sense8, the Wachowskis. We'll tell you where you can find all of their work online, and we'll discuss the ups and downs of their careers. And probably we'll make, I don't know, how many jokes about knowing Kung Fu? Allison, three,
I'm
four?
I'm going to say, let's keep it in the 3 to 10 range.
Okay. And how many times am I allowed to say, whoa, like Keanu Reeves?
I'll give you a dozen.
Whoa.
It's one.
That's one. I've got 11 more. But first up, it's Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films that are new on demand. Allison, you have our picks this time. What's the first one?
Well, first up is a movie that is now available on demand and is one that I really liked. It is 71, which is directed by Jan Demange, and along with Startup, which we talked about here on the podcast, is one of the two films that put Jack O'Connell on everyone's radar before he went on to his bigger and frankly less interesting role as Louis Zamperini in Unbroken, his kind of the big Angelina Jolie directed Oscar-y movie that came out towards the end of last year. In 71, he plays a British soldier who is sent to Belfast in 1971 in the midst of the Troubles. And basically on his first day on the job, ends up getting stranded and left behind in the middle of the city in this turbulent, dangerous, and mostly hostile neighborhood. And he spends the whole night out trying to get safely back. And meanwhile, there are different kind of forces at play, including some of the Protestant loyalists working on a bomb. A lot of the kind of Catholics, you know, like are ready to, and especially the younger branch of the IRA are ready to shoot him on sight. And then there's like the British kind of intelligence agencies who are like working with at least one side and maybe both. And in the middle, you have O'Connell, who is just so good at seeming both young and kind of brash and daring and also just terrified. And he spends a lot of this movie justifiably terrified and putting a very human face on the kind of ongoing turbulence and just kind of like disaster going on that he's dropped in the middle of and is really good. This is an action movie, really, though I think it also manages to glance on a lot of just the total complications of the scenario, especially then in 1971.
This is the front line, boys. Catholics and Protestants living side by side at each other's throats. Divided by the Divis flats. But do not enter the flats. They've become very dangerous.
Hold the line! Retreat!
So it's great. It's a really, it's a really exciting movie while also obviously being kind of a brutal one. So that's 71, and it is now available on demand. Also now available on demand, two movies that you may have seen already. They're both movies that I like a lot. One is, I think, one of my favorites of the year so far, Ex Machina, which is available on demand on July 14th. This is Alex Garland's directorial debut, starring Domhnall Gleeson as an employee at a tech company who randomly wins a contest to go out into the wilderness and spend a week with the reclusive CEO, played by Oscar Isaac, who is always good and is such a pleasure to watch as like a programmer in this. And he's there to actually help test his new invention, an android, who is played by Alicia Vikander. And I think that this is the kind of sci-fi that is really, you can totally get excited about, because it deals with a lot of very interesting ideas about humanity, about ethics, about kind of what it means to have artificial intelligence. But it's also just like very creepily and evocatively directed. It's got this like Bluebeard kind of theme running through it. With the, you know, the monster with, or the man with the closets that you're not, the room that you're not supposed to look into. And I really loved how it played out. So Ex Machina is now available, or it will be available on demand on July 14th, as will Clouds of Sils Maria, which is the latest film from Olivier Assayas, starring Juliette Binoche as a famous movie star and stage actress who is coming to a sort of turning point in her career. She's been asked to revisit the play that made her famous, except this time she's going to be playing the older role against the part of like the younger woman that was her, you know, breakout. And it's this meditation on aging, on performance, on celebrity, on art. And Binoche is always great. But I think the standouts here are in particular Kristen Stewart, who plays her assistant. And there's a lot of interesting tension there in having one of the most scrutinized, actresses in modern day Hollywood and like kind of like most paparazzi hounded actresses play this very normal assistant who is not only the force of kind of pragmatism and like the girl who's kind of like looking a little bedraggled and like sneaker wearing girl all the time, but also the one who's totally aware of gossip sites and aware of the machinery of celebrity. She talks about it a lot, and there's something fascinating about that. Also, Chloe Grace Moretz is interesting, kind of playing a little bit older, actually, as this American actress who has seen her fair share of scandals already. It's a very smart movie and a kind of enigmatic one towards the end, anchored by these three strong performances. So if you like Olivier Assayas, he's always someone whose movies give you a lot to think about. And this one is no different. Clouds of Sils Maria, available on demand on July 14th.
I have Mr. Jung on the line again. He told me if you don't pick up, his next call will have to be to the authorities.
I knew you would be back. This is where you belong. Someone is stealing from me.
If I confess to your crime, the company may be able to survive.
I don't know how, but I know you're afraid.
You are no longer just you. You have seven other selves.
What am I?
On the last episode of Film Spotting SVU, your listener's choice options were the first season of the Wachowskis' new Netflix series, Sense8, the first season of the new Amazon Prime series, Catastrophe, or the new Elmore Leonard adaptation, Life of Crime. And it was indeed a catastrophe for Catastrophe, which got just 14% of the vote. Although, frankly, if I'd had a vote, Allison, that's probably where mine would have gone.
Okay.
I'm actually looking forward to watching that. I'm preparing for a trip for work, and I just downloaded the first episode to my Kindle, so I plan on watching that. So forget you, SVU listeners. I'm watching it anyway. In second place was Life of Crime with 20% of the vote, but with 65% of the vote, the winner this time was Sense8. And this is the first television series by the Wachowskis, Andy and Lana, best known for creating the Matrix trilogy, one of the most popular and influential science fiction series of the last 25 years. The years since the Matrix trilogy, though, have seen the Wachowskis, I would say, struggle to connect with audiences in the same way they did with the story of Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus. Their live-action speed racer made less in its entire run in theaters than the Matrix Revolutions made in its first 3 days of release, its opening weekend. In 2012, they made Cloud Atlas, an even more ambitious film based on a supposedly unadaptable novel that made even less money than Speed Racer. And this year's Jupiter Ascending, which was supposed to be last year's Jupiter Ascending until it was pushed back from its prime summer release date to the dumping ground of February, didn't do much better. Structurally, Sense8 bears a certain similarity to Cloud Atlas in that it's an ensemble story. It has a bunch of diverse characters, and it is about how these separate individuals, even in their myriad differences, represent a certain sort of universality or express the commonalities of the human condition. The difference was that Cloud Atlas was set in six different time periods, and generally speaking, the characters from each story didn't interact or blend together, even though each one kind of influenced the other in certain ways. Sense8, on the other hand, is set in the present, and it's eight heroes, which range from an Icelandic DJ to a Chicago cop, to a closeted Mexican movie star, to a transgendered woman from San Francisco. They all share a mysterious psychic bond which enables them to communicate across vast distances and even borrow each other's special abilities. Now, we're going to talk more about the Wachowskis and their work in our Q-Shot segment a little later, so let's stick to Sense8 for now. My question to you, Allison, is this. What did you make of the Wachowskis' transition from film to TV? Do you think they got the medium the way they get the medium of film? And do you want to see a second season of Sense8, or would you rather Andy and Lana immediately go back to the world of cinema?
I am fond of this series, even though I think it has some significant problems, particularly in what you're getting at in terms of TV structure. This is a series that attempts to juggle eight separate storylines in addition to having a kind of larger one in theory,
right,
about this world, this kind of conspiracy.
These Sense8s, yes.
Yes, in terms of like what the Sense8s are and also this conspiracy in which they seem to be hunted.
Right.
And I think that it is much better at dealing with these moments of connection, which is clearly where their interest is,
yes,
than in managing to make all of these stories compelling or even necessarily to balance them out that well. There are times where I've seen the whole series. I know you have not. I finished the first season. I would say that there are times in which I forgot what was going on in a particular character's life because some of their storylines are much more interesting than others. And each episode sets up parallels in which whatever's going on in one person's life will kind of have echoes in someone else's, which is how they're able to help each other as well and relate. But I don't know that it's certainly a really difficult thing to attempt, but I don't know that it always pulled that off. And the whole larger storyline is very slow to kind of be revealed. It comes through for a while in the storyline of Nomi, who is the trans woman and the activist. There's very little information revealed until towards the end of the series. And even then, it's not a lot. I would like to see another season of this, sure. In part because I also don't think the Wachowskis are... someone's going to be rolling out the red carpet for them in terms of a movie anytime soon.
Probably not.
Or certainly not, like, on the scale that they want to work at.
Right.
There's no... You know, this series has not been renewed yet, either.
Okay.
The Sense8. Netflix has not. Despite whatever, you know, operating on whatever, like... metric Netflix uses to but I appreciated the scope of it throughout, even as I didn't feel like they really had a handle on it. I think that that's the kind of thing that a first season is for, to figure that out. So I think that a second season would also have a bit more forward motion, or at least that I would hope. But I don't know, Matt, you did not finish this, and there was a reason. Tell me what you thought about their approach to television.
Well, part of it, the reason I didn't finish was just I had a busy week and weekend, the holidays and stuff.
But
so
do you see yourself finishing it?
No, I don't. I don't. And it was a struggle for me to get through it. I watched 7 episodes, and first of all, this is really silly and nitpicky, but why isn't it 8 episodes? It's Sense8. There's 8 people. Shouldn't it be 8 episodes? And maybe that's more my frustration with the fact that I did find... this one of the slowest moving shows that I've really tried to watch. I'm not saying there aren't slower, but in terms of shows that I really like didn't just give up with and grappled with as long as I had time to and really could take, I was sort of going, oh my goodness, there's just nothing really going on here. And I agree with you that the moments of connection are occasionally very profound and beautiful. And I think the premise of the show is brilliant. It's a classic comic booky sci-fi premise, and it really speaks to me. I would love to see the I don't know if it's more mainstream or just more accessible or more story-bound version of that of this idea, where you have these 8 people who are all interconnected and they can kind of coach one another through these dark moments in their lives, and they're essentially like a Justice League almost of ordinary people who can kind of access each other's abilities, and they're like part therapists and part coaches. And I think that's a great idea. This version of that idea, I really found kind of, frankly, pretty boring. I really did. And there was a couple of storylines I liked, individual characters that I liked, because even though they do kind of meet and cross over mentally, a lot of it is just their individual lives, and they each have a storyline that they're dealing with. And I found one or two interesting, and I found the rest really just kind of lacking in any kind of interest. I did like, I mean, maybe it's because it's the fact that she has the part that is the most about the conspiracy, but I did like Nomi's storyline and her backstory, and the fact that she seemed the most sort of, I don't know, it seemed like the most tension and richness of conflict there, because her family is somehow involved and her mother doesn't agree with becoming a woman and all that sort of stuff. So there was kind of, I just felt there was more going on there, and I liked her girlfriend. I thought was probably the best supporting character of the whole show. So I like that storyline a lot. I also like the storyline involving the closeted Mexican actor, because that storyline, again, also has some conflict, some drama, a lot of comedy, actually. There's some really funny moments. And it seemed to me like the Wachowskis were kind of poking fun at themselves in some moments, in terms of, because he makes these like really macho action movies, there's sort of a scene that's kind of poking fun at like Bullet Time and The Matrix and
like
slow-mo
wires,
fighting and wire food.
Yeah.
And I just thought that they were having a lot of fun with themselves in that sequence.
Well, a lot of that storyline is also about the idea of finding profundity in genre fiction.
That's true. Right? That's a good point.
Which is especially the type of genre fiction that the Wachowskis do.
That's a great point.
You know.
Yeah, I agree. And so I like those two storylines a lot. Like if the whole show was a storyline about a show about Nomi, or I probably would be more into it. I guess the other ones I haven't mentioned yet, and maybe you can kind of defend them. I'd love to hear you kind of argue for some of them. when some of these characters would come on the screen, I would just kind of sigh and go, okay. And the other thing was, I would really lose the thread too. You know, like a character would come on screen, you'd have a scene that was maybe interesting, and then you wouldn't see them for the rest of the episode or for more than that, you know. And I just felt like you were right. My question earlier to you to start the segment was a little bit leading, because I don't know. And this maybe isn't just them. This might be a Netflix thing or a streaming thing, a larger issue we could talk about. Because I feel like, and I think we've talked about this before on the show, but the idea of binge watching a show, I almost feel is now having like a pernicious effect on television specifically created for streaming services. Because the whole concept of binge watching, which kind of came organically out of viewers, because they were watching these shows on like DVD when, you know, like The Wire was released on DVD. I personally like binge watched the show because I was working at a video store and I was just taking the discs home every night and watching 3 or 4 episodes every night. The show was that addictive. You had to find out what was happening. There was larger stories, but every episode had a mystery or had something. It was moving forward. This show is more like, it's like a 12-hour movie, I guess, because there really aren't each individual episode I did not find to be a satisfying unit of storytelling, where I would watch an hour and I would say I don't feel satisfied, like I got enough, but not where I was like, oh, I can't wait to find out what happens next. It just, there wasn't a lot to hook me. And even the cliffhangers I found really underwhelming. Like the example I wrote down in my notes was, the cliffhanger to episode 5 is one of the characters faints. Oh my goodness. And then the next episode doesn't show her for like more than 15 minutes. And it's like, well, what happened to that character? Like, maybe they just weren't interested in that, but I found it frustrating, very frustrating.
Yeah, I did not have a tough time with this in terms of like getting through it. I really, honestly, like House of Cards season 3 felt slower to me.
I mean, that's another example that I would agree did feel like they were making it under the presumption of everyone's going to watch every episode. We don't have to make it as, and I think that's where we talked about this problem.
Yeah,
and I thought this show suffered from the exact same issue.
Yeah, I don't know. I think what you run into with this show is also that, while I do feel like it lacks that kind of like underlying narrative that provides the series with that forward momentum that makes you want to be like, what happens next? What happens next? It's also kind of unapologetically a sci-fi series that is not that interested in the global conspiracy, like what's happening, you know? It comes to life so much more in these little human moments. And I think that there is something very vibrant about, and something I really liked about, how the characters initially kind of, you know, think they're hallucinating or think that they're like, they don't know what's going on. And then also they just accept it. Mm-hmm. Ones that are not attached to the conspiracy at all, who have not really been told, who are not touching the character who kind of explains and provides background.
Right.
But everyone else just kind of accepts it, and also accepts that this, like, their lives include these 7 other people within their scope, mm-hmm. who can kind of provide solace or provide, you know. And I think that there is something that comes through in those moments that is very lovely about the concept of never being alone, mm-hmm. you know, that like this concept of kind of like shared connection. And I thought I really appreciated the way that the series handled that, as much as it kind of floundered in terms of generating conflict. You know, like, there are storylines in this that I had to remind myself. The Berlin character, like, I still...
Do you even know his name?
Wolfgang, because there's a part towards the end where it gets repeated a lot.
Okay.
And they call him Wolfie as well.
Okay, because I didn't know it off the top of my head. I'm looking at it. Otherwise, if you had asked me, I would have been honest and said, I don't know that character's name.
I did not know the name of the character in Mumbai. Like,
I didn't know her either.
And I did not remember...
Is it Kala? I'm looking at the
Kala
list.
Yeah. You know, and I did not know the name of the character in Nairobi. Like,
right.
Yeah. So here's my question for you, though.
Yeah.
This, like Cloud Atlas, is a story that attempts, like, very kind of like openheartedly to have characters from all walks of life and all parts of the world. Did you feel that the creators were able to handle that? You know, having a character... I mean, that's a challenge as well, to be like, how do you write a character who is like a van driver in Nairobi, presumably like, I don't know how much contact the Wachowskis have had with, like, you know, what it's like to be in Nairobi.
Meaning, like, a question of authenticity? Like, how authentic did that season?
Did you feel that they were able to have those characters exist beyond maybe a certain kind of, like, I don't know, in the same way, like, a Icelandic DJ, you know, like this, like, did you feel like did those characters ring true to you, or did they feel like some...
There were certainly moments where I questioned it in terms of their language. Now, granted, everyone's speaking in English, but I think the idea
is... Which is a problem sometimes.
I think the idea is supposed to be that they're speaking in their own languages, but rather than making us read subtitles, they're speaking in English. So maybe that's part of it. But it did seem at times where the dialogues felt more like things that an American person would say more than an older Asian woman might say, for example, or that someone from Nairobi might say, and that I questioned some of that. But I think that they would argue that the whole point of the movie is about, or the show rather, is about universality, and I think they would probably say that that's the point, is that they're trying to show the commonalities between these people despite all their differences. And I did find that kind of endearing about the show, and the fact that it is such an incredibly diverse cast, you know, different genders and different sexualities, and I like that about it too. I thought that, you know, that it's a nice kind of corrective to a certain kind of stodgy old-fashionedness. I guess the authenticity didn't bother me as much as sort of the compellingness. I just didn't find a lot of richness to some of these characters, like Riley, the Icelandic DJ. I just didn't really care about her storyline at all, and it seemed to involve a lot of her just kind of wandering around, moping, and, you know, there's a lot of characters whose storylines are so passive and just sitting around, not doing anything. The character in Mumbai, Kala, just, you know, should I get married or not, which I think could be a really rich and interesting storyline, but I just found the way that it was handled, at least through the first 7 episodes, was a lot of sitting around and kind of looking sort of forlornly, and occasionally having another character from another part of the world coming in, and she has a lot of scenes with Wolfgang, and, you know, sort of their, like, attraction. And I feel like if that storyline was maybe compressed, that could be interesting. But after 7 episodes, having so little happen, it's just like the snail's pace. The feeling I got by after 7 episodes was like, this is a show that's being told entirely in bullet time. Everybody's just moving in slow motion, and I just wanted things to speed up a lot, not even a little.
Yeah, I don't know. In terms of their attempts, or their kind of, like, fearlessness in including characters that from all over the place, I appreciate it, even though I do think it is fairly clumsy. Like, I don't think that the storyline of Will, who is the Chicago police officer, and Chirac, and their treatment of, like, gang violence there, I think that's, like, a pretty, like, I researched this on the internet and then wrote this storyline kind of take on it. And yeah, at the same time, I really do appreciate, like, how willing they are to try.
Right.
You know?
They're ambitious.
Very bold about that.
That's something that we can talk about more later. They are not afraid to try to include a character that maybe they don't know all that well. And that I do find something likable about that. I was wondering this, not to interrupt you, but speaking of the diversity of the show, I almost felt like because there is, like, sort of the straight white guy cop character, Will from Chicago, I almost felt like he was boring on purpose. Did you get that sense ever? That they were almost trying to make him kind of bland to sort of to sort of, like, accentuate the need for diversity, and not only in this show but in general, that they just I was trying to justify it a little, because I found him so boring.
Yeah, I kept getting him, like, mixed up for a little while with the Berlin guy who was a criminal, but they look a little alike.
Yeah,
and yeah, I mean, they are kind of the least interesting of the group, which is an interesting twist, but I don't know. I mean, I think that it doesn't always, they also don't always, I didn't love the fact that there are 2 romances within the group, which kind of, and, like, fairly traditional romances, you know, in that way, that I kind of wish that there had been, that hadn't been, like, the obvious narrative, one of those obvious narrative drives. But I don't know. That said, I appreciate that there is, you know, I love Baiduna. I don't think that that acting in English is, like, great for her, but she's an actress that I love seeing on a, like, bigger platform like that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that Tina Desai, who was in the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, I think, you know, is a very promising actress, and that you see a lot of that, you know, in getting to do a bit more, even if that storyline's a little slow. And Jimmy Clayton is a trans woman playing a trans woman.
I thought she was great.
Yeah. And I think even if that storyline requires a lot of like her just kind of flatly saying, you know, like saying like a lot of these theses about like she's almost like an internet treatise at points, you know, in terms of what she delivers. But I think, yeah, she's great. And I love that the show also in, like went with that casting and like told that storyline. And I mean, that storyline in many ways felt like the most kind of like, like emotionally resonant, I think.
I agree. I completely agree.
But yeah, oh, the one other thing I do want to mention is that I really do admire how like this show, the show's approach to sex and sexuality, like it yes. has sex scenes of a sort that I have never seen, you know, ones involving like this trans actor, but also the kind of like goofy for a long time Mexican storyline in which there's like a closeted couple and then this woman who kind of forcefully becomes their beard, their live-in beard.
Yes.
And also sort of they're like almost like part of this love triangle in ways that I have never seen before. I really loved that. In that, I just, it felt like something new.
Yes.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen that before.
I completely agree. And again, you're sort of both, but you're also mentioning like the two storylines where that you've cited were the ones that I liked. And I agree. Those, that was another thing that I found pretty bold about the show, but it, that's literally 25% of the show is those two parts. And yeah, I don't know if it's something that's inherent in the structure of this kind of story, because it is kind of like a crash, a sort of supernatural, like kind of a crash movie, or an, you know, one of those movies about ensembles with a diverse group of people that's about an issue and they kind of, they have these connections, and this is sort of that. It's not that far removed from
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but it's also about, you know, in ways, all of those stories are about how we're supposed to see the kind of unwitting connections, thematic connections between
that they all
the storylines.
But
these stories are explicitly about, you know, like someone being like, let me tell you how this thing that's happening in my life halfway around the globe like has relevance to you.
That's absolutely true. I was thinking more in the terms of the fact that when you tell that many stories, all the characters, they get like their amount of time we can spend with them gets shrunk down and they get flattened out and they become more what they are can be described in three words. Oh, that's the Icelandic DJ. Not this is the Icelandic DJ who has this and that and this. They just don't have the richness of character that you would have if the whole show was about Nomi. If she was the main character and we spent the entire show with her and we could just follow her quest and maybe slowly bring in eight other characters like that. She, as she discovers the truth, we kind of find like maybe I'm not trying to tell them how to make their show. I just think that it almost seems like a byproduct of making the show this way, just, you know, as ambitious as it becomes and as diverse as it becomes, is you just don't get a great sense of the characters,
so
especially right away.
It needs a Piper in order to get to season two of Orange is the New Black.
Maybe, but that's interesting because the season two of Orange is the New Black almost abandoned Piper, uh-huh. where she became a minor character. I mean, this is the third season, which I have been watching and enjoying. She's a slightly more important again. But yeah, she's barely in the second season. So I don't know. I just, it's like if you describe the show to me and what it is and what it's, who it's by, what it's about, I would say this sounds fantastic. And I've been looking forward to this show and I was looking forward to watching it. And then the actual experience of watching it, I just found so frustrating. And it's just, I just kept sitting there going, I was trying to will myself to like it more, like because it has so many things that I do like and I would feel like I would enjoy, and I just kept, I don't know, I just did not enjoy the experience of watching it. I was like, this is like The Matrix, and there are certainly some storyline points that are just like The Matrix, but this is like The Matrix if you did not see Keanu Reeves learn Kung Fu until 10 hours in or something like that, because I watched 7 hours and very few of them had learned Kung Fu, so to speak, like barely. And they were still 7 hours in doing that thing of like, who are you? What's going on? How is this happening? Like you said that, oh, they eventually start to accept it. And I got by where I was in the show. Yes, I saw a little bit of that. But it was still like sort of like the scene, you know, you can almost predict the scene of like the person discover, like seeing someone they don't expect for the first time and going, oh, my goodness, like. It still felt like they were still in the very beginnings of fleshing out this mythology after 7 hours. And that, at least to me, that was a lot of time to ask me to devote without giving me something in return.
Yeah, I don't know. It worked for me. I think that there is something to the way that it is led by characters rather than by its conspiracy that mm-hmm. I appreciated, as much as it required more patience. But I think there's really something to be said about sci-fi that is much more invested in the kind of emotional journeys of its characters than in story, much as that may drive you insane.
Drive me personally insane. All right. Well, we are definitely a little bit split on Sense8, but if you want to watch it yourself, it is available now on Netflix.
Here he comes, here comes Speed Racer. He's a demon on wheels. He's a demon and he's gonna be chasing after someone.
We're thrilled to have SundanceNow.club back as a sponsor on this episode of Film Spotting SVU. .club is a new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries.
.club brings the human voice back to movie recommendations. Unlike other services, .club's films are handpicked by expert programmers with unique perspectives, as well as cultural icons like Ira Glass or Susan Sarandon.
.club's library of documentaries includes incredible stories of all types, including crime, history, politics, music, and sex. And as a SundanceNow.club member, you also get exclusive benefits like free movie tickets, access to film festivals, award shows, and more. And I took a look earlier today at the newest additions to .club, and the one that caught my eye this week that I would have most liked to watch right now if I wasn't watching episode 7 of Sense8 would have been Page One, Inside the New York Times, directed by Andrew Rossi. This film, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2011, chronicles a year in the life of the Times, and it follows several different reporters and editors as they go about their daily lives. And Rossi happened to be on hand for a crucial time in the history of the Times and really all of journalism, as you know, the old print models are giving way to this digital future that we're all living in. But the reason I really want to rewatch it now is that one of its main characters, its hero, really, in a lot of senses, is this guy by the name of David Carr, a media columnist and reporter for The Times who passed away, sadly, earlier this year, and who has some great scenes in this movie. Maybe the most famous one is the one where he takes this meeting with several guys from the media company Vice and absolutely schools them on the reality of reporting. If you're a fan of David Carr, or if you're just curious about the lives of reporters at the New York Times and modern journalism, this is a really fascinating film, one you should definitely check out. Page One, Inside the New York Times.
Film Spotting SVU listeners can watch Page One and many more documentaries by going to SundanceNow.club and signing up for a free 30-day trial to try out their service. You can get your free 30-day trial at docclub.com/SVU. That's docclub.com/SVU. Take a look at the career of Lana and Andy Wachowski from start to Sense8, but we wanted to note right now they're fairly limited streaming options in terms of their movies. Bound, their directorial debut, is streaming on Netflix, and The Animatrix, which is more this kind of tangential animated anthology series related to The Matrix,
sort of set in the world of The Matrix,
exactly, is available on Netflix as well. But everything else of theirs is available for rent via all of the usual platforms, so their stuff is very easy to see.
Yes,
it's just not that easy to see on subscription services. So Lana and Andy Wachowski, they began their career in comic books, and I think it's been very interesting to see that they've been looked at as these kind of iconic, I don't know, like sci-fi people from that world, but they've become like, they're not fitting into that anymore. They're still doing sci-fi, but it does not fit into a kind of like dude mentality anymore.
That's interesting. And not just a dude mentality, but a comic booky thing.
Right.
I mean, they, you would think, would be the ultimate wish list directors for one of these big comic book movies. Because as you said, they did get their start writing comic books, and then really the comic books were so influential in their film work. I mean, especially The Matrix is so comic booky.
Yeah.
And really a lot of their stuff that they've done since then. Now they've produced like V for Vendetta.
Which they wrote as well, right?
They wrote and produced the adaptation, yeah. Supposedly didn't direct it. There's, you know, you hear urban legends that they were, like, secretly directing it or whatever, but they're not credited on it. But they certainly worked on the film, the version. But that's not, you know, V for Vendetta, it's an excellent book. It's an Alan Moore comic book. It's a graphic novel. But it's not Superman. It's not, you would think that someone would have poached them for that. And, you know, it's funny, you were saying earlier that they, you know, you're wondering after the string of flops that they've had, who's going to come knocking on their door to make another $175 million ambitious, arty sci-fi movie. And maybe that's not what's going to happen. Maybe what's going to happen is they will finally make one of these adaptations. Maybe DC will, you know, they've made a lot of movies for Warner Brothers over the years. Maybe they will finally convince them to make something in their library. And I don't doubt that they could do a fantastic job. I think that the reason maybe that they haven't done it, and this is something I want to talk about with you, is that they've had so much success with The Matrix, financial, creative, everything. And then even though people don't love the sequels, they made a ton of money, you know? And they made the Animatrix, and they made video games and action figures. It became a whole universe that it gave them a certain amount of creative autonomy that in some senses they've been sort of like slowly
eating away at
that.
All that goodwill.
Exactly. Through all of these flops, which we can discuss also, and which I like some of them a lot. Like Cloud Atlas, we didn't talk a ton about it. I compared it to Sense8. I think they are very similar in a lot of ways. I love Cloud Atlas. I didn't like Sense8, but I think that's a great underrated movie. I didn't like some of their other movies so much, but I don't think that it's all been bad movies. I just think they haven't necessarily all connected. But what I'm kind of curious to discuss with you is sort of just has all of that cachet been all necessarily a good thing? The fact that they've been able to do whatever they wanted. Do you think that maybe having this many flops and perhaps having a future where maybe we'll see them direct, I don't know, Green Lantern or something like that, would that maybe be good for them? Would you be interested in seeing that? Or would you rather them keep making these very idiosyncratic, very personal visions?
Oh, I definitely want them to keep making these. I think I'm not very interested in a Wachowski superhero movie. I'm sure they'd be good at it. But I just feel like they're doing something that is so weird and so different and so exists in such a different way within kind of like a culture of like kind of sci-fi and fandom and like and general geekiness that just is so different from the mainstream. And I really... I want them to keep doing that.
Mm.
But let's start with Bound.
Okay.
Since it is the movie that is available on streaming. And it is the movie that with which they made their directorial debut. And also is the movie that is not kind of out there in some form of like weird sci-fi surrealness. It is a thriller and a kind of like intimate one that happens to have as its main characters two lesbians and has a lesbian romance in addition to a theft. I was rewatching a little bit of this. I didn't have a chance to go back and look at the same thing,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing. But I do think that like the way that the romance between the characters is portrayed and like this it's a sexy movie. Like they definitely, it has like some famous, particularly scenes of seduction.
Yes.
Is that it doesn't feel like it's leering at them, you know, in a way where if you tell someone, oh, Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon and like this hot lesbian romance,
right.
Like, that sounds like it's going to be like softcore porn, right?
Right.
And it doesn't feel that way at all, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you think about it because it was their first movie and you go, well, how do we make a first movie? And it's like, how do we sell a movie in Hollywood? And it's like, hot lesbians stealing from the mob, and the movie's called Bound, so it almost sounds like it has this, you know, bondage-y element. And it's like, but then you're right that there, and this filters through to all of their stuff. There isn't they do have a lot of sex, including up to Sense8. Sex is a very big part of a lot of their movies,
and it's very kind of, I don't know, there's like a certain joyousness to it.
Yeah, I agree that it's not ever a thing that's tawdry or sleazy, but that it is kind of freeing and beautiful and celebratory, which, yeah, it is unusual in, well, certainly in American movie making, yes. In general.
We're like, shame, where is the shame?
Right, that there really isn't that, and that it's often the complete opposite. It's that's, and it's sometimes is the sort of like the element that transformative element, because transformation is always a big part of their movies too. It's like that is like intrinsically connected with sexuality in a lot of their films. So yeah, that's an interesting observation. I didn't have a chance to go back and watch it, and I haven't seen it in a long time, but that is absolutely what I remember about it. Sort of the sexiness of it, but that it's not like it doesn't feel tawdry or sleazy or like an exploitation movie, but that it, like, they find a way to make sexy movies and sexy sex scenes without it being kind of like leering and gross and horrible.
Yeah.
Which is a skill.
It is a skill. And I think, you know, in this movie, it essentially just like gender flips the main character, right? That Corky, the character who's like an ex-con played by Jonah Gershon, there's like a movie in which that character could be played by a guy, and that like it's just this femme fatale, potential femme fatale, trying to get him to like get her out of this relationship. And it is, it does, I think it is a neat twist on this kind of noirish plot otherwise. But yeah, it was an interesting debut, and it was one that I really liked, and one that really like demanded your attention.
Now, I didn't finish Sense8. I watched 7 episodes. But at a certain point, when I realized I'm not going to finish the whole show, it's not possible, feasible. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to rewatch the original Matrix, which I haven't seen in a long time. And I rented it and I watched it. And I was just like, yes, yes. Because I was at some point, I was like, is it me? Am I just like, am I out of it? Am I losing it? And you know, I haven't enjoyed some of the more recent things that they've done, and you do get to that thing where you go, was that thing that we loved really as good as we thought it was, or was something pulled over our eyes because maybe, you know, the effects were so cool and it had some interesting ideas? But I have to say, looking back at it, there is a lot of exposition in it. It is a lot of people saying, well, what is this, what is that, which is I noticed that more than I had when it came out. But it is still, it's so fun and interesting, and it has all these ideas. And one of the things that struck me is about looking at it again is that Sense8 does have a lot of the similar themes, ideas. I just, you know, it's funny because The Matrix is a sci-fi film and it has all these sorts of ideas in it, but it is sci-fi, action, kung fu. It's the genre first. And it's like, I think you might have even said during our review, Sense8 sort of flips that, where it has the genre elements, but it's much more interested in the sort of the idea of connection and universality and finding people and empathy and all of these sort of bigger things. And I don't know. I wonder if it's maybe, not that those things don't have value, but I'm wondering if maybe there's a middle ground they could find, that perhaps they've gone too far into preachiness per se, and they've sort of lost a little bit too much of the entertainment value, perhaps, for me, that maybe I'd like to see just a little bit more of the Matrix sense of that movie moves. It is propulsive, right? That it's just like go, go, go. And they keep breaking up the scenes where they're explaining things with fighting scenes and action and chases. And it's like, it has a sense of energy to it that I did feel like was lacking from Sense8.
Yeah. I have not had a chance to see this movie for a long time. And it is funny that, like, such is the reputation of The Matrix that it kind of carries the rest of the trilogy with it.
Yeah.
Despite, like, the general disappointment, I think, that was with which the two sequels were met. You know, that, like, you can have two sequels that sort of, I don't know, should in theory exhaust all of that goodwill, and yet they haven't. The Matrix is still a classic.
The first film itself, and they really milked, like, not just with those sequels, because they made video games and a online multiplayer game and the Animatrix, and they really milked that sucker dry. But the first movie, it's funny because I also was, that movie inspired so many terrible, you know, bullet time-esque special effects,
oh, yeah,
wire work in Hollywood stunts, and just
cyberpunk cliches.
Cyberpunk cliches, absolutely.
The men's rights activists who talk about taking the red pill.
Yeah. So arguably, it had a negative overall effect on popular culture in terms of it influenced a lot of people to make a lot of bad art. And I was wondering if, looking back at it, I would say it wasn't worth it. But it is really a fabulous movie. It is so great that it is, it really, it surprised me, honestly, how much I enjoyed it. Because I kind of was looking at it going, oh, I wonder if I'm going to look back at it and go, you know, it hasn't aged all that well. But it's fascinating.
And it does engage As much as I don't think that Neo is all that built up a character, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I don't think it gets in the way of the movie. But it does engage fairly seriously with this idea of, like, it's like, you know, half, which I think is like emblematic of their career, half a profound idea and half like a stoner idea of like this secret reality and like of the consequences is being dumped into this truth where there's no going back, you know, and maybe it'll be much worse than the blissful ignorance in which you were living before.
Yes. That's funny.
It takes it very seriously.
Yes.
That idea. And I think they have never, certainly throughout their career, they have never been afraid of tackling with these ideas that are,
they
not
could be silly,
right? They can, and sometimes they are silly,
but they treat them with absolute
fine sincerity. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I mean, that sense of sort of like ideas hatched during a druggy haze definitely filters through a lot of their movies, or maybe movies that were meant to be watched in a druggy haze. That's sort of that's what I think of Speed Racer. It's like Speed Racer seems like something. And I've never really liked it, that movie, but I feel like if I was a drug user, that would be my favorite movie.
Oh yeah,
to watch.
It's like a giant hallucination,
right?
Like those, especially all of the race sequences,
the colors, the movement,
but also like these impossible race, like racetracks,
right.
You know, that like include like looping up around and like include spikes on the track and like these cars basically fighting each other. You know, I went back and rewatched that like yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, as it's one of those movies that I feel like you fight, you kind of resist. I feel like it's very difficult to watch it and not like resist it for so long because it is like here's a story about a family named Racer, who are the, you know, who build race cars. The son is named Speed, and they are going to try and save the racing industry from evil, like an evil corrupt billionaire. Like it takes it so seriously and so at face value. But I have to say, like the end, like really made me tear up a little. The last montage that is like, just like this, like the insane triumphant like moment. Like there's something about like their commitment to that.
Go Speed Racer.
Yeah. No, it's just like something about their commitment to it and reaching for at least this like sublime in this ridiculous thing
right
that I really appreciate.
I tried to rewatch it when right before Jupiter Ascending came out. That was when I was like, because that film, which was not a success, roundly trounced by a lot of critics, although it had a few defenders, has sort of slowly taken on a certain cult classic status that I wanted to give it another chance, and I couldn't even finish it. I actually, you know, it's a theme with me and the Wachowskis, I guess, because I had the same reaction with Sense8. Like, I watched half of it, and I was just like, I can't. It's just not for me. You know, it's not connecting with me. So I didn't get to the end to sob at the triumphant Speed Racer montage. I'm sorry. But
yeah.
But I will say, I give them a certain amount of credit and respect for taking that concept of a live-action Speed Racer movie and making something weird and different and not making... There is a much more conventional, accessible version of that movie that could be made that probably would have been a huge hit, and they did not go that route.
Right.
And even if I didn't enjoy that movie and I still don't like it, I give them a certain amount of credit for following their peculiar muse wherever it led them into this strange, druggy, trippy, hallucinogenic version of Speed Racer. You know, like, they're the only people who would have made that version of that movie, and there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, as much as I think that it's there's a lot about that movie that really doesn't work, the idea that, yeah, they could have made, like, a kind of gritty version of Speed Racer in which it explains his name, it explains, like...
Or he has a different normal name,
right,
and his nickname is Speed Racer.
Absolutely. And, like, and it's just this, like, basically a normal racing movie,
right?
Like car racing movie,
exactly, like a NASCAR movie.
His girlfriend is named Trixie. He's like,
right.
Yeah, but I don't want to watch that movie. You know,
right?
I would rather watch something that like totally fails half the time, but then has these moments of sublime, honestly, than a kind of mediocre, like gritty version of that story.
Now, that sounds like a lot of their movies to me. These moments of the sublime,
I mean,
mixed
like,
with some
whole,
really frustrating
right.
parts.
I mean, well, like the whole point of Cloud Atlas is reaching for the sublime,
yes.
Right? Like, is this these like kind of ineffable moments of connection, especially when you have this story that like it doesn't just hop eras and it doesn't just hop continents, but it also hops genres. right?
Mm-hmm.
There's like the historical drama. There's the post-apocalyptic one.
Yes.
There's the 70s conspiracy theory.
Yeah, there's
one.
The futuristic future one that's kind of Matrix-y.
Exactly. You know, yeah. And I think that...
I mean, Sense8 is kind of like that as well to a certain degree. I think Cloud Atlas was more successful in that respect, yeah, in terms of merging these different genres into one film.
Yeah, but it, you know, also to really very sincerely try and tell, like, to deal with ideas of how the powerful treat the weak, right? Mm-hmm. Like, as in this, like, recurring theme. I mean, I think you like Cloud Atlas a little more than I do, but I do, like, really, I am really impressed by its bigness, you know, its scale, its kind of attempts to go to places that I've never seen movies go to.
Hmm. Well, that leaves us with one last film here, Jupiter.
I think this is where our paths diverge.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is where one of us takes the red pill and one of us takes the blue pill.
I like Jupiter Ascending.
You're going to make a case for Jupiter Ascending. All right, let's hear it.
I don't know that I need to make a case for it.
Yeah, you do.
All right. Well, here's what I will say.
Okay.
And I'm going to borrow this argument that Gavia Baker Whitelaw at the Daily Dot made.
Okay.
Which is that we watch giant blockbusters all the time that are terrible, that get written off as fun, like trashy fun.
Okay.
That are kind of male centric.
Okay.
And Jupiter Ascending is that like that from a very female perspective, that it is basically like a teenage fanfic, you know, brought to giant epic life.
Okay.
That it is a story about a girl who gets swept up by her space werewolf boyfriend, you know, and gets made into Princess of the Universe.
Right.
And then realizes that it's terrible. And then, you know, and then figures out a way to save Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it works weirdly well while being frequently silly. And I do actually think that the kind of thread running through it about I hate my life, right? That mm-hmm. there's like this story that kind of comes back around from the beginning, from what the main character says, who's played by Mila Kunis, to this story that's told by the villain at the end, that I think has a weird resonance to it. That in this, you know, this like hyperspace capitalism that she kind of jumps into, that everyone is just as miserable, but like on a grander scale, I think is... as a fable, there's something about it that kind of works.
I wish I saw the movie that you're describing, because I, you know, like the idea of like a sort of typical dumb fun blockbuster, but from a female centric point of view. I mean, that sounds great. I didn't really feel like the Jupiter Jones character got to do anything fun or
that's
feel
a guy,
like
no the, you see I feel like that's why
this is why
like,
I'm
is
wrong
a, no but it is like a male, I feel like there's like a particular like, and in Treatment of This, like guys who are like, well, she just gets rescued all the time,
right?
Sure, it's like female fantasy. It's your hot werewolf boyfriend, like scoops
okay.
you up, and you know, I feel like I, you know, certainly she's not like a strong female character, but I don't think she's a terrible one, and I really liked that this was a story in which someone figures out, someone is told they are the most important person in the universe, which happens in like basically genre fiction all of the time, right?
Including every other movie the Wachowskis
yes.
have made.
And that she's not good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I actually really liked that she showed no particular skill or like a gift with, you know, giant space corporation machinations.
Right.
That she was just a normal girl, the normal girl she was before, mm-hmm. who was already making lots of bad choices
mm-hmm.
and was generally lazy. And that she was still that on a space princess level.
Right. Yeah, I guess I just, it seems like we just see the same things and just feel differently about it. I
yeah.
mean, the other issue I had with this movie was that it just felt, to me, just totally baffling and cut to ribbons. And, you know, as much as we've talked about how the Wachowskis have used the clout and power that they had after The Matrix to do whatever they wanted, this was the first thing that they made that I felt like, it felt like maybe there might have been some studio notes and meddling, because it just seemed like this movie was cut. I mean, I don't remember. I'm looking it up right now. It says it was 127 minutes. It feels to me like maybe, again, a question of ambition. They maybe tried to bite off more than they could chew. But I just felt at 127 minutes, it just felt like half a movie was missing. Like, there was so much that didn't make sense, and why people were doing what they were doing, and the intricacies of this mythology that just all seemed lost to me. That was had been cut out of the movie, and I think I heard somewhere that the original script of the movie was like 500 or 600 pages, and it felt like it to me. It felt like something that was really big that had been just chopped down to the point where it was just a dumb, propulsive action movie where I kept going, what is this person? Okay, he's a dog man, and he's a werewolf, and he has wings. We used to have wings. He's got rocket skates. And it's like, nothing made any sense to me. And I guess I should have just gone along for the ride. But if in 5 years they said, there's a director's cut of Jupiter Ascending coming out, it's 3.5 hours, would you be interested? I'd be like, heck yes, let me see it. I don't think I ever want to see the version I saw in the movie theater in February again, but I would love to see a longer version that made a little bit more sense.
Well, I mean, do you though? I feel like...
Yes, I do.
No, I mean, I feel like I appreciate that, and I would agree that this one feels like you can feel a studio hand in this one more than other ones. But I feel like what you're asking for is like more of the exposition that you didn't like in other things. You know, like I mean, I wonder if it's one of their problems.
They don't know how to handle that in a more graceful way.
Also, just like they seem to have trouble with going from introduction into action. Maybe. You know, if Sense8 seems to be all introduction. Until right. It arrives. Like, basically, it's all the first episode of something.
Yeah.
I mean, if Jupiter Ascending sounds like for you, it's missing a bunch of episodes.
Pay up. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe that's, maybe. But I love, like, the visual design of that movie is so spectacular. And it seemed like it felt like someone had put a lot of thought into it. I just didn't get to hear any of the thought. You know, like, if the exposition was compelling enough, I don't think I would mind if it was a little heavier on exposition, because it is this incredible, you know, this whole massive universal conspiracy of planets and a dictatorship and the universe and the humans being used as batteries and all this stuff. It's like, it seems kind of interesting, but I didn't understand any of it the way that it was presented in the movie.
Yeah. I'm a fan. And I feel like if you haven't seen it yet, out of all of the ones we've talked about, it's the one I would say give a try to, because
of their like less known or less seen movies. I would definitely say go Cloud Atlas is the better film.
I would say go with Jupiter Ascending. Mm. It tries to do something I really enjoy, even if it does it imperfectly. So, well, there we go. Our recommendations.
There you go. They can decide which movie to try next based on how often they agree with me or with Allison. All right, now it's time for the segment on the show where we talk about new movies. And Allison doesn't know the name of the segment.
To be fair, you also flubbed the name in an earlier version of the earlier take of this. So.
I can neither confirm nor deny that in a outtake of this episode, I could not pronounce the name of this segment, which is Singer and Wilmore's completely concise and totally succinct new release roundup. I got it right this time at
very
least.
Very nice. Very nice.
So there is a couple of movies coming out this coming Friday or Wednesday, whenever they're being released this week. We have both seen the big one. Allison has seen one other fairly large film. Why don't you tell us about that one first, and then we'll discuss the bigger movie.
Sure. Well, and also, there's one movie we haven't seen yet, which is The Gallows, another Blumhouse horror film.
Yes.
They're showing it this week, but neither of us have
seen
it yet.
All I know is it's a horror movie and involves like a guy with
right?
a noose. A noose.
Yeah.
Like The Gallows, hence a noose. But it seems like they're really selling the noose thing. Like what horror movie like weapon haven't we used? We got lots of machetes. Freddy's got his hand. What can we do now? A noose.
Yep.
So
we'll see. But the movie I have seen is Selfless, which is the new movie from Tarsem Singh, and it is starring Ryan Reynolds as Ben Kingsley. Ben Kingsley initially as this really wealthy man who takes part in an experimental procedure introduced to him by a character played by Matthew Good, in which he can have his mind transferred into a new younger body before he dies. And that body is played by Ryan Reynolds. There's some joke there. I'm not going to make it. But anyway, I didn't like this movie very much, but it for a moment, like, you know, I've talked about the movie Seconds.
It sounds
podcast.
A lot like Seconds.
It has like maybe a half an hour, which is like Seconds, and where it's maybe the most interesting part of the movie.
Right.
But then it becomes this kind of conspiracy where you realize that like he thought he was getting a new body that had been grown in a vat, but actually it was a used body that maybe has a family that doesn't know what happened, you know, to the original owner. and it becomes rapidly much less interesting. Also, you know, Tarsem has made some movies that are kind of famously gorgeous, if not always very coherent,
yes.
like The Cell. Mm-hmm. And this is weirdly not a very visually interesting movie.
Oh, that's
which
disappointing.
Is very disappointing
yeah.
coming from him, because that's always been
that's his trademark.
Point.
Yeah.
So it's not one that I would bother with, honestly. But yeah.
Okay.
I can give that a pass.
All right. And then the one that we've both seen, probably, I would guess, is going to be one of the huge hits of the summer, actually.
Yeah.
I have a feeling it's going to make $1 billion, and I'm going to feel old and disheartened,
yes.
is Minions, which is about these three yellow blobs from a large race of yellow blobs.
Keep going.
And their names are Stuart, Kevin, and Bob. They wear overalls, and they get into wacky adventures, and they live to serve a master. And in the Despicable Me movies, they have this master played by Steve Carell. And this one, this is a prequel, the origin of the Minions, because I know you're all dying to know where they came from, where they find, before they found Gru, they find this other master who's Scarlet Overkill, another supervillain played by Sandra Bullock. Giving, I would say, one of the blandest vocal performances I've ever heard in my life, where... To say she phoned it in, I think I wrote in my review, is an insult to phones, which are useful and wonderful and have never hurt anybody. And I just thought she was really bad. And in general, I hadn't seen the Despicable Me movies, so I can't compare it to that. All I can say is I felt like I was watching the movie U.S. Marshals, where they gave the Tommy Lee Jones character his own spinoff, which didn't work because Tommy Lee Jones was great in The Fugitive because he was the supporting character. And these little critters, these minions... They have their moments of kind of wonderful little like physical comedy because they can't speak English. They speak gibberish. As the leads of their own movie, I found them inadequate in terms of supporting a story and character drama and everything. And then you pile on top of that this main human character, this Scarlet Overkill, just completely bland and boring. That it just I just found the movie had a couple of chuckles, but just not very memorable at all.
Yeah, and there are times where it feels like a giant toy commercial. Like, it does feel like this kind of giant leveraging against, like, these cute characters who... It's a movie about nothing in particular. Like,
right.
It really, like, its plot is, like, so kind of weirdly inconsequential and
yeah.
And illogical. But, like, yeah, it's entirely about, like, oh, these characters are adorable and kids love them. And, like, they're just going to do cute things.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We are literally too old to understand
them. We are just too old for the Minions.
So, I feel like this is a movie, too. You know, this is in a summer with, like, Inside Out, which is such a children's film that's so rich that this is the movie that parents are going to take their children to and then sit there just befuddled and,
yes.
like, feeling, like, horrible about their lives.
Right.
While their children are probably going to be laughing. I mean,
yes.
I saw this at a press screening where there were a lot of children, and
right.
they laughed, and they seemed...
They cheered before it started. Like,
yeah.
there was a lot of love for the Minions.
Yeah, they seemed... I would say they seemed mostly into it. There were some dry spells, it seemed like, but they certainly enjoyed it a lot more than I did. So, yeah. No, I guess I would say that going in, like, for parents, I'm sorry.
Yes.
You're going to have to deal with the Minions now and probably forever, because I'm sure they're going to make 10 more of these movies.
Yeah, so maybe not the strongest week at the cinema.
Not at the cinema. But
fortunately, we have things on demand and on streaming to recommend to you.
That's right. So let's get now to Behind the Eight Ball, our segment where we recommend some new releases, three of them to be exact, and then we give you some listener recommendations, two of those to be exact, that you guys emailed to us, and then we wrap things up with one film chosen blindly by number from our Netflix My Lists. Allison, do you want to go first? You want me to go first?
I would love to go first.
All right. Well, then why don't you start with three new releases?
Well, these are three movies that I haven't gotten to see yet, and they're kind of on my list to catch up with 2005 releases. So I'm very happy to see them all turn up on streaming recently. The first is Faults, which is now streaming on Netflix. It stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead as a cult member whose parents have hired a deprogrammer to, you know, restore her to sanity / basically kidnap her and, like, bring her to a hotel room and try and talk her out of her allegiance to this cult, played by Leland Orser. And it's written and directed by Winstead's husband, Riley Stearns. It's his directorial debut. And it's one of those small movies that I heard a lot of good things about, and that it's kind of like a, you know, just the two of these actors in this hotel room. And I really like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and I'm really intrigued by any story of cult deprogrammers. It's an underexplored niche. So that's False. It's now streaming on Netflix. Streaming on Amazon Prime is Slow West. This is a Western starring Michael Fassbender as a mysterious cowboy who helps a young man, played by Cody Smith McPhee, who's traveling to find his true love. And this is another one that, you know, it was kind of traveling on the festival circuit for a while. I think multiple people called it out as being a little Coens-esque. I just never managed to make my way to it. So it's one that I'm looking forward to watching now on Amazon Prime. And one more that is new to Netflix, Hard to Be a God. This is the Russian film directed by Alexei German and is about a group of scientists who travel to a planet similar to Earth, except in the Dark Ages. So maybe like Earth, you know, centuries past. And they then have to kind of contend with the brutal behavior of the people they're seeing and, you know, try not to let themselves interfere. And this is a movie that, you know, got a tiny release, but I've heard a lot of people talk about. It's not necessarily the easiest one to watch, but it is supposed to be remarkably, like, very striking and disturbing. So I'm happy to add it to my list queue. That is Hard to Be a God on Netflix.
Okay, and how about two listener recommendations?
Oh, first up, we have one from Leslie, who writes, "For the summer, I am rewatching the Bollywood Doom trilogy. The series combines a buddy cop theme with insanely fun musical numbers. The actors, costumes, and settings are beautiful. The films are individually quite long, so I have to watch them in chapters. And I need to make sure the cooler rater is on because this film causes me to jump out of my chair and dance along with the film. Yes, these films are silly and the plots are convoluted, but they make a fine summer watch. Doom 2 and 3 are on Netflix. I love the podcasts and the snappy, sometimes snappish repartee. You guys kick Bodge's butt like a pair of Jason Statham's. Thank you." Really.
I can think of no better compliment. Exactly. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
Yeah, so thank you, Leslie.
Yeah, and we should say Doom, for those who are unfamiliar, it's spelled, Allison,
D-H-O-O-M.
Right, make sure you put the H in there, yes, if you're looking for it.
And this was like a monster Bollywood hit.
Yeah.
This trilogy.
Yeah.
And then we have a recommendation from Daniel from Jacksonville, who writes, "Not sure if you've decided a movie for this week's episode or not, but maybe give The Hunt a look. It's currently on Netflix, was up for an Oscar for Best Foreign Film, and has a pretty strong performance by Mads Mikkelsen." That we are a big fan of The Hunt. We actually have already talked about it. It was the main review January of last year on episode number 52. But I think we were both very fond of it then, and can definitely second that recommendation. The Hunt, currently on Netflix.
All right, and one film chosen blindly by number from my list.
You gave me number 61. That is How I Live Now, a movie starring Saoirse Ronan as a American teenager who is sent to the English countryside to stay with her aunt there for the summer, only for World War III to break out and for England to basically crumble into anarchy. You know, it's your basic YA story about terrorists, trauma, and first cousin incest, and there's nothing I like better. So it has been on my list for a while now.
I think it's time to bump that one up a little higher.
Right?
It's a 61. That should be in the teens at the very lowest.
Yeah. All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, three new releases.
Okay, first up on Netflix, one of the first and most influential of all buddy cop movies, 48 Hours, from action master Walter Hill. A super young and very charismatic Eddie Murphy stars as Reggie Hammond, who sprung from prison by San Francisco cop Jack Kate, played by Nick Nolte. And they have 48 hours to solve a crime before Reggie gets sent back to the slammer. It's funny and exciting. It's definitely a whole lot more interesting than many of the buddy cop movies that came in its wake. Sort of like The Matrix with the Matrix derivatives. 48 Hours is to its derivatives. It's a very interesting movie. Often imitated, never duplicated. Not even by Walter Hill, Eddie Murphy, and Nick Nolte in another 48 Hours, which is kind of terrible. And also streaming on Netflix, I recommend you stick with the original recipe, 48 Hours, that is also now streaming on Netflix. Also now streaming on Netflix, a core text in the field of Schwarzeneggernomics. The original Conan the Barbarian from 1982, directed by John Milius, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a slave who becomes a warrior on a quest to find the man who killed his parents. He's basically like Batman, really, when you think about it. He's Batman in like olden times with a sword and an Austrian accent. Netflix says that this movie is, quote, violent and, quote, imaginative. And I, quote, agree. And I would add, quote, awesome. So that's Conan the Barbarian on Netflix. Finally, now on Hulu, is Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams, a 2010 documentary originally presented in theaters in 3D about the art of the Chauvet Cave, the oldest known paintings in the entire world. They're cave paintings, and they're like in the neighborhood of 30,000 years old. And I know that sounds like more sedate subject matter for Werner Herzog, who tends to prefer more extreme settings and scenarios for his movies, but let it be said that the air in this cave is so toxic that the crew could only spend a couple of hours at a time in the cave, and they could only stand on a walkway that was like 2 feet wide to shoot these paintings. You know, it's not dragging an entire steamship up a mountain, but it is something, and the artwork is really incredible and beautiful and powerful to look at. And since we can't actually go physically see it for ourselves, this is probably the closest any of us will ever get. So that is Cave of Forgotten Dreams, that is now streaming on Hulu.
All right, two listener recommendations.
Our first one comes from David in Brunswick, West Australia. Listener in Australia, that is great. David writes, "Hi, Allison and Matt, I have a suggestion for listener recommendations. Many would be forgiven for thinking that shows like Game of Thrones, catering for both the highbrow and the lowbrow in one show, is a new thing. However, listeners should be pointed to the place where that really got started way back in 1976. The show I am recommending is I, Claudius, currently streaming on Hulu. This great show stars Derek Jacobi, John Hurt, and even Patrick Stewart appears in it, along with many others, set in Rome from the time of Augustus to the rule of Claudius, plotting, double-crossing, and deranged rulers abound. Thanks for continuing to produce a very enjoyable show. Ciao." That's from David in Brunswick, West Australia. Thank you, David. And our next recommendation comes from Kagan in Salt Lake City, Utah. Kagan writes, "Hey, Matt and Allison, the show is amazing. I love listening to you talk about movies. Always looking forward to the next episode. I wish it was weekly." Does not compare us to Jason Statham, though.
Oh, well, in our hearts.
So I'm sorry, Kagan. Maybe if you had compared us to Jason Statham, we would do the show weekly, but instead, it's going to stay biweekly. Kagan writes, "I wanted to recommend the film Society from 1989. It is currently available for streaming on YouTube for free. Not sure if the studio knows it is there, but this is the only place currently to see this film online. This movie is for anyone who thinks they've seen every 80s film. It was quickly dismissed in the U.S. when it came out. It isn't perfect, but it's really unique and fun. The ending is so memorable and horrific. I highly recommend it. I think it would be a fun film for you two to review. Keep up the great work." From Kagan in Salt Lake City, Utah. Thank you very much, Kagan.
All right, one from your My List.
You gave me number 36, which is another film about teenagers. It is the documentary Teenage from filmmaker Matt Wolff, and the description from Netflix is, "This film explores the origins of the modern-day teenager, a demographic that didn't even exist until the mid-20th century." And this one came out just a couple of years ago. Sounds like a fascinating subject. Just haven't gotten around to watching it yet. That is Teenage, and that is available on Netflix. Allison, we have a group of three recent indies to choose from as our new listener's choice options. You have the first one. What is it?
Well, it is one that I've already talked about. It is Faults from Riley Stern, starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and currently streaming on Netflix. And I think, you know, maybe we could do cult themes. There are some interesting cult movies out there. I think there's a lot to talk about. But
cult meaning movies about cults.
Yes, about cults. I think we've already maybe even done one on cult movies.
Yes.
But yes, movies about cults. I think, you know, that might be something we can do.
Definitely.
Yeah, and it's a movie I'm interested in seeing, and it sounds like there's a lot to talk about in it.
I haven't seen that one either. Another one that I've already added to my my list. So I'm looking forward to seeing that one as well. That would be an excellent choice. Our second option is not on Netflix yet, but it will be streaming on Netflix starting on July 14th, which will give us plenty of time, and you plenty of time to watch it before our next episode, and that is a new horror film and a new indie horror film called Creep, directed by Patrick Bryce. And I'll read you the plot description. I think I got this from IMDb. When a videographer answers a Craigslist ad for a one-day job in a remote mountain town, he finds his client is not at all what he initially seems. And Patrick Bryce, the director, also co-wrote the film with his co-star, he stars in the film as well, Mark Duplass. So Mark Duplass plays the client. Patrick Bryce plays the videographer. And I've heard a lot of good things about this movie, that it's very low budget, very lo-fi, but that it really uses the kind of found footage-y aesthetic, which I can be a fan of under the right circumstances. It uses it in an interesting way, that it's a really disturbing movie, that Mark Duplass gives a really good performance. I think I just almost called him Mark Duplass, but that was an accident. That he gives a really good performance in the movie, and this is another one I'm really looking forward to checking out. It just came out in theaters and on VOD, but it'll be on Netflix on July 14th. That's Creep.
All right, and we went for a third American indie, recent American indie, for our third pick. It is Amira and Sam, which is now streaming on Amazon Prime, 2014 film, written and directed by Sean Mullen. And it stars Martin Starr of Freaks and Geeks as a veteran who's come back from war and who starts a romance with an Iraqi immigrant who is in the U.S. illegally and who is played by Dina Shahabi. And it's a romantic comedy. And I feel like I've heard some good things about it. And also that it just it tries to, you know, have a romance from two very unexpected characters and, you know, uses their perspectives to explore some themes that just don't come up much in romantic comedy. And it, really, indie film has been what you have to rely on for a romantic comedy these days. Mm. The studio versions have been some pretty dire stuff.
Yeah.
So I always want to take a look when there's an indie that kind of does something interesting with the genre.
Indie romantic comedy could be a good theme, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's Amira and Sam, and it is streaming on Amazon Prime.
Okay, so which recent American indie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, July 13th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you will have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on our next episode, which will be on Tuesday, July 21st.
Filmspottingsvu.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all of the movies and the occasional TV show we discuss on the episode. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the review that you pick. And in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. It's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice poll. And we share more streaming suggestions, titles that you may want to check out that are new. And always send us your recommendations as well. If you've seen something that you like, we always need more recommendations to the show. You can send them to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. And for Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.